How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
So welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. Hope everybody's doing well, staying healthy. Numbers getting scary out there. And in just a little bit, we are going to be talking to Miran Feder. David, remind us why we love Miran Feder.
Miran Feder. Delightful reporter for Bleacher Report and does an incredible job. And Miran's talent is that she does not write about games. God bless her. She doesn't write about a single solitary game. She writes about people in sports and writes these incredible features on people. And wrote one, I believe, and she'll correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure I am, about 2 years ago on Giannis Antetokounmpo, who is the star player of the Milwaukee Bucks, and his journey, his story as being a Greek-born basketball player whose family was from Nigeria, but he was born in Greece, so he's Greek, and the incredible kind of racism that he had to overcome in Greece.
Yeah. As we'll say to her, the book's called Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. I've never had a title that was so accurate as this one. But it's Jamie McIntyre's with us. Jamie, Lauren is filling in for Claude. Not that anyone could ever fill in for Claude, but Lauren's doing a wonderful job. Jamie McIntyre, welcome back. We hear you were in Cooperstown for an anniversary trip.
My wife and I were celebrating our 44th wedding anniversary, and she's a huge baseball fan, and we always wanted to go to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. And we went up. We had a delightful time. It's a beautiful part of the country. And the timing was great because it was just after the induction ceremony. So we just missed Derek Jeter. And just before the big fall foliage influx into that part of the country. And it was delightful. And the Baseball Hall of Fame, if you're a baseball fan, there's just a ton of fun stuff there.
Yeah. What did you like the best?
Funnily enough, I like the collection of baseball cards, including a section. They had a section of baseball cards that had been improved by kids.
That's a great idea.
Kids who had taken their baseball cards and like drawn horns and mustaches and other things on the cards. And I thought, this is what we did with our cards. We didn't think they were going to be worth anything. This is what we do with our cards.
Yeah,
that is pictures on them.
Okay, how many years have you and the lovely Roberta been married?
44, but who's counting?
That's a long. Brian and I are coming up on 30. David, what about you?
We are at 22 married, 33 together.
Okay, honest to God story. If you held a gun to my head or my husband Brian's and said, when you guys got married and someone said you'd be married for 29 years, what would you say? We'd like, no, absolutely not. I think it speaks to how fast time flies, not how great our marriage is, but I think that the fact that time flies, which is pretty amazing.
The other thing is, after you've been married, while you get to a point where you really, your options for an alternative are really limited. It's not like anybody out there is going to want me and give me the same level of attention. So
I think you're selling yourself short.
You know, my dad used to say, God rest his soul, my dad used to always say, not my last house, not my last wife.
Yeah, I always said
the biggest investments in life. Good for him.
I always said the secret to happiness is one house and one wife.
I know a couple, fabulous marriage, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. They're on a plane one day and it hits horrible turbulence, as in we're all going to die. The plane is going down. She reaches into the pocket behind the seat in front of her and pulls out the bag you use if you're getting sick. And she starts writing names on it. And her husband goes, what the hell are you doing? And she goes, I know how this works. The plane's going to go down. I'm going to die. You're going to live. These are the women you can marry after I'm gone. And he's looking at her going, you've thought of this? You had this list prepared? She's like, yes, I did.
I don't have a list for my wife. Do you have a list?
It's a really short one. David,
by the way,
David's on the list. David's on the list. Right.
our listeners at home can't see this, but am I mistaken, Tori, or do you have a new do?
No, I just happened to wash my hair today.
It looks
I got good. And I got a haircut finally.
Well, that's what I meant.
You know, during the pandemic, once every 10 months.
Looks very stylish.
Whether I need it or not. Thank you.
You people at home will just have to imagine.
I've never thought about people that could marry my wife. I guess I need to think about that.
Yeah. Very short list. What's that expression? Women grieve, men replace. Because men always get remarried much faster after getting rid of or losing the first one. And, you know, we will just grieve forever. Okay, speaking of anniversaries, this is a sports trivia question. And, Dave, you can't answer.
Okay.
Jamie,
I'm not
going to
know the answer.
You might know it. What happened 48 years ago today? It's not a marriage thing. It's something important that happened 48 years ago today, September 20th. David, are you just dying? Are you just dying?
Milot, dying. Home run? I don't know. Is it a baseball question?
No, it's not baseball. Different sport.
Joe Namath won the Super Bowl 20 years ahead of time. No, I don't know.
No. I have no David, idea. Put him out of his misery.
I believe that was the Battle of the Sexes.
Yes. Billie Jean King, Bobby Riggs.
Yeah. I do remember that, but I didn't remember when.
Yes.
Okay, remember. I was not a baby, but I vaguely remember that. But
yes.
And David, you were even younger. You only know of the lore of it, right?
I watched it and I was rooting for Billie Jean because she seemed kind of cool and Bobby Riggs seemed like an old fart. And you know. But with no, I didn't know why I was rooting for Billie Jean King. I had no idea. I didn't know.
Okay, so David, don't tell Tori, but Tori, who won? Do you know who won?
Of course she did.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, of course she did.
The HBO movie was actually not bad, I thought.
It was not bad at all. And I am just amazed and impressed by her, and Tony Kornheiser is just in awe of her. Mm-hmm. And so I read a lot and I pay attention a lot, and I've gone back and I've read some stuff, and I think, oh my gosh, when you think about what it takes as an athlete, David, you can speak to this, to perform at that level. It takes enormous concentration, dedication, focus on your game, nothing else. She had so many other things she had to deal with, and she did deal with, and so many other things and causes, obviously, and people she took on while she's trying to perform at her absolute best as a tennis player. I find that most impressive.
I mean, she had the whole women's movement on her racket, essentially. You know, I mean, there was no other athlete that was still playing. Numerous female athletes over the years had said, hey, this is not fair. We're not getting paid as much. We should be getting paid. But she was one of the top two or three players in the world at the time and had a lot of attention coming her way and was trying to start the Virginia Slims Tour. I mean, it had started, but it was not a big success yet, you know? And so if she loses the match to Riggs, who had already beaten Margaret Court, who was considered the best player in the world at the time, it would have, I don't know if it would have ended the women's sport. It would have, I think, dealt a major blow.
Yeah, it would have set it back significantly in the amount of money they got paid and things like that. Yes. And she's trying to deal with her own identity.
Correct.
At the same time. So I'm just so impressed at her ability to keep so many things in the air.
So here's a cultural trivia question based on
go.
That. What was the ad tagline, the slogan for Virginia Slims?
Oh, cigarettes. I should know this.
I can see the figure. I can't remember the tagline.
I can see her smoking, right? Like a roaring 20s woman smoking. You've come a long way, baby.
You've come a long way, baby.
Wow.
There you go. You've come a long way, baby, to get where you've got to today.
There you go.
Now, do you know the historical significance of Virginia Slim cigarettes beyond Billie Jean King?
No, tell us.
I'm pretty sure that the Virginia Slim cigarettes were the last cigarettes ever advertised on television on the Tonight Show in 1971.
Wow.
Now that's
when they banned cigarette advertising on TV. And one of the last models for Virginia Slims was an actress named Veronica Hamill, if you remember her.
Oh, from my Hill God, Street absolutely. Blues. Oh, she was hot.
I'm a font of useless information.
Like that is the best trivia. Wow. That's awesome.
That took us down a rabbit hole.
That's very good.
I'm sorry. I'll just drink from now on.
So hopefully Mirren's gone to get a drink. Hopefully she noticed that David and I
told her.
So she went to get a drink. There we go. But speaking of impressive people, I want to do some shout outs to some of our Chatter on Books alums who are being featured and honored these days. So Disha Filia, author of The Secret Lives of Church Ladies. Maggie Shipstead. Remember her, Jamie? You asked her why her name was Shipstead.
Yes.
Author of Great Circle, and Robert Jones Jr., author of The Prophets, are all in the National Book Festival this week, the next several days, which is huge. And then I just found out yesterday that Robert has been long listed for the 2021 National Book Award for Fiction, which is huge. I just want to say they were here first.
Coincidence? So, I don't think so.
I don't think so. You know what they say about, so something happens once, whatever. Something happens twice, it's just a coincidence. And if it happens three times, it's a trend. So we're now up to about six Chatter and Books alums who have been honored and won big stuff. So I think that's pretty cool.
You're a king maker and a queen maker.
There we exactly. go.
Your track record speaks for itself.
We are gender fluid. We'll honor anybody if they get us listeners. Okay. So David, here's a question first to you. And then Jamie, this is going to be your time to shine. David, when's the last time you bought and or read a book by Bob Woodward?
I'm thinking the last book I bought of Woodward's was... I haven't bought any of the politics books. I must confess, since The Final Days.
It's okay.
I read Wired, which was the Belushi book, which, depending on your point of view, was either brilliant or awful.
Right.
I'm trying to remember if I read any. I don't think I read any of the Supreme Court books.
Okay.
I think it's probably Wired. I know that's a long time ago.
No, but one of the reasons I ask is I think so often there are books, Washington books, and Woodward's books are Washington books that are so heavily covered. And Bob Woodward has mastered many things, including knowing how to promote and how to psych people up about things in his books. They're so heavily covered, I feel as though I don't need to read them. I just don't need to read them. I know that the best stuff has been covered and I've heard it analyzed. I've listened to it on the radio. So I don't need to do that. I'm like, I can't really remember the last time I actually bought one. But Jamie, the latest controversy for Bob Woodward's book, latest book, Peril, is? Take it away.
Well, the controversy surrounds comments and things that the Joint Chiefs Chairman, General Mark Milley, allegedly said. And the whether these were just perfectly normal routine interactions or whether they were something that undermined civilian control of the military depends a lot on the nuance of very particular quotes. There's two things there's concern about. One is that he supposedly gathered senior leaders together at the Pentagon, which he did, and talked to them about what to do if the president were to order a nuclear strike against either Iran or China.
Not a bad conversation to have.
And which in some context could be perfectly appropriate. But the book alleges that Milley said knew that he was, quote unquote, pulling a Schlesinger, which was a reference to James Schlesinger in 1974, who told his subordinates in the Pentagon, if President Nixon ordered a nuclear strike, not to carry it out without checking with him, which would be a break in the chain of command and would be undermining the president's authority. Right now, the president of the United States has the sole authority to order a nuclear strike. So there's a question about whether he did what Schlesinger did, or whether he just said he wanted to be part of the conversation. And then the second part of the controversy was he had a couple of phone calls with his Chinese counterpart to reassure China that the United States wasn't going to go to war, which is, again, perfectly appropriate for the chairman to do. But the questionable part is he's quoted in the book as telling his counterpart, look, you know, if Trump orders a strike, you know, you've known me, we've known each other for 5 years, I'll give you a call and tell you. So in other words, he would tip him off to a strike ordered by the president. And setting aside whether...
Is that a short phone call, Jamie? Does this call and go duck? How does that go?
Yeah, I don't know. But now this raises the question, though, you know, you've been mentioned in a Woodward book before, right?
You know, my favorite Washington game, any conversation, make it about me, which I can do. It's a telling point. It's a telling point. Mirren, hang with us. I promise. We're going to get to you in your fabulous book. This is important. So unfortunately, many years ago, I did have to spend some time with Bob Woodward and show up in one of his books. I guess his first book about the Bush administration. I don't remember what it was called. And anyhow, three mistakes. I was in maybe two pages, three mistakes. I'll do the best one last. First of all, he had Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, calling me at 6:30 in the morning at home to say, hey, get ready, we're going to the Middle East anew today. This is so offensive because in those days, if you were at home at 6:30 in the morning, you were a loser and you were so irrelevant. I had been in the office for 2 hours by that point, right? That was offensive. And then secondly, he described a scene in Rumsfeld's office and Secretary of Defense office saying, a meeting of the five or six top people around Black Jack Pershing's desk. The Black Jack Pershing desk in the Secretary of Defense's office, as Jamie knows, is huge, is massive. no one ever sits at it. It's just, it's not even possible for people to sit around that desk. But in the Woodward style, that's a lot more fun than seeing six or seven people huddled around a little folding table over to the side. Second mistake. Third one is the best one. He referred to me as Victoria A. Clark, which is so fascinating because my not only is my middle name not start with an A, I don't have a middle name.
Like Harry Truman.
I have absolutely no idea where he came up with that. So I'm sorry. Okay, Jamie, you've got CNN headlines version to finish this, wrap this up.
Well, later, if you ever ask me, I'll tell you another anecdote about Bob Woodward. But the point is that both of these incidents hinge on the accuracy of this very specific picture that Woodward draws. And as you know from your personal experience, sometimes he gets little things, not usually big things, but little things wrong. But in this case, it's the little things that make the difference between whether Milley is somebody who undermined civilian authority or whether he was just doing his job and following the Constitution.
Right. And so, for example, right after 9/11, a lot of very senior people in uniform and civilians were on the phones nonstop with all their counterparts around the world, good, bad, and in between, saying, okay, everybody just calm down. Let's stand down exercises. Remember that, Jamie? They stood down a bunch of exercises because they didn't want it. That kind of stuff happens all the time. But to Jamie's well-informed point, the difference is, did he say, don't worry, this won't happen on my watch? Did Milley say, I'll give you a heads up? You can't do either. He's not even in the chain of command to say those things. I don't know Milley well. Jamie knows him better. I doubt he said those things.
And so because in Woodward's style, he puts sentences in quotations, but he's reconstructed the quotations from either the original source, he may have talked to Milley or people around him. And then he writes it as if there was a transcript or a recording. Right. And in this case, the nuance makes a difference. And I'll just throw in just one other example. In this his latest book, Peril, he describes a scene in which Adam Smith, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, is flying back home to Seattle after the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. And according to the book, there's a lot of Trump supporters on the plane. They don't recognize Adam Smith. They're just all talking about how they've lost their country. And in, according to the book, Smith hears a lot of anti-Semitic and other you know, conspiracy theory stuff talked about on the plane. Well, Smith said, no, that didn't happen. He said he did talk to Woodward. He told him about the plane ride, but the stuff that he heard that was anti-Semitic was at the actual assault on the Capitol, not on the plane. Nobody on the plane said anything anti-Semitic at all. So again, it's a minor point, but these things all hinge on this. Now, we'll hear on the 28th of the month, Milley has to go before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he'll be asked all about this, and it'll be very interesting to hear what he says.
It will be. And if he has to contradict Bob Woodward, that's going to be a very hard thing to do. Okay, but let's welcome in Mirren Fader.
Yes.
Mirren, what do you think? Mark Milley, up, down, your thoughts on, you know, national security of the 21st century?
Talking to China.
Go ahead. Yeah, talking to China.
This is not on my list, okay? But I do like commercial books. I mean, I have to admit, I just finished Sally Rooney's new book. But
that's a good one.
This one is not making the list. I'm sorry.
Yeah, nope, sorry. Sorry. It's an interesting world that Bob Woodward has built. That's all I'll say. Mirren Fader, welcome to Chatter and Books. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. This is
great,
so cool.
So you and David chat among yourselves. How do you know each other? You sat courtside. David,
no,
do you remember when you first
you,
met?
Mirren doesn't do games. She writes about people, which is so much better.
Yeah.
So better. I just been a fan from afar. And then I got to go on your pod, which is so fun.
Many people. Mirren, one time, a couple years ago, pre-pandemic, my family's and a couple other people at a hockey game, big Caps fans. And during the game, I'm texting back and forth, and David happened to be there. So we're texting back and forth. It's not like David and I never saw each other. Like, ooh. And I said, hey, let's meet on the concourse between what, first and second period, David, something like that.
Allegedly, yes.
And so I hop up after the first period and turn to my family. I go, hey, I'm just going to see David out in the concourse, and I'll be right back. So I up the stairs, turn right, and I see David, and all of a sudden I realize there are 18 people right behind me. And my family and their friends are such groupies, such David Aldridge groupies.
I'm saying.
Talking along. Then they were embarrassed to get their picture taken with David. It was very cute.
He's very sweet. Very sweet, but completely irrelevant to Mary and me on the show.
Okay, Mary, there's so many things I want to talk about with this fabulous book, Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. Jamie, do you have your recording teed up anytime we have to pronounce his name?
You mean the pronunciation of?
Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Yeah. There we go. Perfect. You started, I want to know what started first, your basketball career yourself or writing?
Yeah, it was basketball. I mean, I wanted to be in the WNBA, but there is one problem. I am 5'0" and I played my whole life.
You could be the Spud Webb of the WNBA.
That's right. Yeah. Mugsy Bogues was like my idol. And I was like, oh my God, I can make it. It's good, you know, and I pushed it as far as it could go. I played my first year in college. And then I was like, oh my God, what do I do with my life? Mm-hmm. And
what was
I
that really, like? Lewis and Clark, right? You played for a year at Lewis and Clark. What was it like playing?
You know, it wasn't what I had hoped. I had a very serious injury before college, and that's what led me there. That wasn't initially where I wanted to go. And so I don't know. There was a lot happening outside of basketball. Like, I took a class called Women Writers there, and I felt like my whole world was exploding intellectually. And I was like, God, like, I really want to be a writer. And, you know, I was spending like 6 hours a day doing basketball. And I was like, what am I doing here? Like, I just kept feeling like I'm in the wrong place. Like, I need to start over. And the next year, I concentrated full time on school. And I was like, I would love to be a sports writer because I still love basketball and I love writing. And I'm just like a huge book nerd, as you can
see. Okay. We'll talk about your books, but I've read where two of your inspirations, Toni Morrison and Wright Thompson.
Yeah.
Those are two very different. So how have they both inspired you?
Well, Toni Morrison, that's who I found in college. And if you read Toni Morrison, there's a rhythmic quality to the way that she writes. It's not only the things she's writing about that are deeply important and, you know, are just the most important things you could write about, but how she writes, it's meant to be heard. It's like a very jazzy, improvisational way that she writes. And I feel something when I read her. And so I wanted to do what she does, which is make the reader feel something and also write in such a poetic way. And then Wright Thompson, I was like, okay, how can I bring this literary self into sports writing? And Wright was like the one example of somebody that wrote about sports, but not really sports. Like, Wright really writes about father and sons. Mm-hmm. And he writes, like, in Wright Thompson's work, place is a character. And it's the same thing in Toni Morrison. And so I was just like, oh my God, these are two literary giants. And I want to be known as, you know, a great writer like they are.
Uh-huh. I've tried to get Wright Thompson to show a few times, and I'll, you know, message him or something or other, and I always get this nice, yeah, sure. And then the follow-up is always, okay, well, here are potential dates. And it's just ghosting.
Just silence.
Ghost. And then I see him tweeting from outside yet another distillery. It's somewhere, yeah. You know.
The best Tiger Woods piece ever was written by Wright Thompson.
Ever.
What made it the best ever?
He figured it out. He figured it out about Tiger Woods. Which is, and Tiger doesn't let anybody in, so it's impossible to figure him out. And Charlie Pierce, who I love, wrote a great piece for GQ many years ago, which was one of the first really good pieces on Tiger Woods, because it wasn't hagiography. It was really a good piece about this young guy. But Wright got to Tiger right after his father died, and when Tiger was just kind of not there mentally and decided he wanted to be a Navy SEAL and spent months training with Navy SEALs, and he went and talked to them. I mean, like Maren said, with place, you could see where he was training as you read it. You could see it in your head and the impossible things that he was putting his body through. And really, it's probably what led to his knee injury was him trying to be a Navy SEAL. It's just this is phenomenal. And Maren's exactly right. Right. And Toni Morrison. Unbelievable.
So that's a great segue to Maren, to your style of writing and reading this book. Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP, made me go back and look at some of the other things you've written. And David talked about this a week or so ago when we were talking about you. You come at them a very different way. It isn't just about the points on the scoreboard or what happens on the court. It is about them as people. Why is that so important to you? And then we'll use that as a segue to talk about the book.
Yeah, you know, I think when I was younger, I really cared about stats, and I had this very like encyclopedic knowledge of like some random journeyman and where he mm-hmm. went to college. And then when basketball was no longer a part of my life the way it used to be, I was really sad and depressed about that. And I didn't care as much. And I found that learning about people's stories and what they had to go through fascinated me more. And so I always vowed to make sure that my stories really were human centric, because, you know, every single person you ever meet, no matter how famous they are, goes through something. Mm-hmm. And I think that is so much more interesting to me than how good they are. In fact, I love covering people that have failed much more than succeeding. So,
well, you're in good company right here. Your show, that's perfect.
And I think, you know, David can speak to this too, is that sports media is a really crowded space.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people doing things. And I just kind of thought, well, there's not a whole lot of people doing what Wright Thompson's doing. I want to do what's different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But okay, David, and actually, yes. Jamie, I have a question for you about this as well, because in your world, Jamie, you have to religiously stay away from somebody's personal feelings, their personal, right? But David, where does a journalist find an outlet for that? Because when you think about the very, it's beyond 24/7, it's of the minute mm-hmm. coverage of everything now, including sports, which is a yeah. big money situation. Where does Miron Fader find the outlets for someone or someplace that's willing to tell those stories? And I love those much better.
Well,
myself.
You know, the good news is that there are a lot more places now than there were right. a million years ago when I started, when it was all kind of legacy media and you had to right. kind of work for the New York Times to be able to have the pull, the bandwidth to get those kinds of stories yeah. in the newspaper or the Washington Post, where I worked for 9 years. And I'll, after the show's over, tell you my Woodward story.
Profile encourage you, Aldridge. Come on.
No. Well, I'll have to finish this. But there's more outlets now, like The Ringer, where Maren works, and Bleacher Report, and The Athletic, yeah. where I work, and right. there's other places that do it now. The problem is there's so much media now, to Maren's point. There's just so much sports yeah. media out there. It is difficult to break through, even when you write something really good. There's yeah. just so people are just, you're just, we're just competing with everything. We're competing with Netflix. We're competing with this phone, not this crappy phone, but a right. good phone. Yeah. We're competing with everything. And it's just hard to keep people's attention for very long.
Right. Okay. But Jamie, give me the flip side of this from your perspective. National security, DOD, it always had to be about the facts, right? There are very few opportunities for you to craft a story the way Miron did behind Giannis.
So before I was a Pentagon correspondent at CNN, I had my own show on Channel 9 here in Washington called Capital Edition. And we did all people.
Was that with an AL or stories. OL? Did you spell AL. It correctly?
Yeah, okay. AL, Capital of course.
Edition. Yeah.
We followed CBS Sunday morning on the local CBS affiliate.
And then when I went Sunday morning.
Then when I went to CNN, I was I started as a weekend fill-in reporter. And I ended up getting all the feature people stories. And the thing that I noticed about doing stories about telling people's stories and doing what we would call feature reporting was that when the stories aired, people loved them. Mm-hmm. They really were related to them. But mm-hmm. I realized when I was at CNN that as much as they loved my feature reporting and clever wordplay and visual, visually rich stories,
right.
that wasn't the path to big success at CNN. I think yeah. Jeannie Most has made a career out of doing yes. funny features, but there's not a lot of feature reporting at CNN. And so when I got the chance to cover the Pentagon and, go to be a frontline, as you said, sort of fact-based, breaking news, nuts and bolts reporter, I grabbed it. And a lot of people, I remember a lot of the photographers I worked with said, Jamie, why are you going to the Pentagon? You're not going to be able to do any of these great features anymore. And I said, because, that's not really what they reward. As I said, they love them when they see them on the air. I would get lots of compliments. Right. Viewers would write in, but that's not what CNN was known for. And so that's how I ended up being, but I would go back and do features about and profiles of people in a minute if there was a big market for me to do that.
Right. But also the nature, and maybe it was the time that you and I knew each other and worked, the nature of the business, you could not get close personally to the people you covered versus that was the strength. I think, Miren, I want to talk to you about this, working on this incredible book about Giannis. You got very close to this person, and he and his family felt comfortable sharing a lot of things with you that they had not shared with other people, right?
Well, it's kind of like access in 2021 is it's trying to look like you're there when you're not there. Yeah. So for example, like I didn't go to Greece, and I had to trick the reader into thinking that I was in Greece. And, you know, I did spend a lot of time with his family, but I could have spent so much more if they would have made them even more available. So I think my job is to take a little glimmer and try to make a whole thing, you know, fireworks with it, that it looks like I spend thousands of hours, but I don't. It's a dogfight. I have to hustle and scrap and make the most out of it. And I am really happy that I got the family, though, because like the mom never talks to anyone. And so I think if she wasn't in the book, I would feel weird about it.
Yeah.
I think like I had been trying to write a book for so, well, not for so long, but, you know, it felt like a long time, like 5 years. And I just kept like striking out like, oh, not a good idea, not a good idea. But when I stopped and said, well, what have I already done that could turn into a book? It organically happened that way. And I think the best books come from something you've already reported.
Yeah. There's a thing about African safaris. You never know what you're going to find when you're looking for something else. And going to do an interview, you were going to focus on his brother, correct? Tell us about the origins of the book.
Yeah, I was just going to profile Alex. In fact, like I didn't even consider that Giannis could be there because he's so famous. And Bleacher Report really cares about the younger people. And I like to profile these young guys before they blow up. So I was like, I wonder if Alex is really good. Like maybe he'll be somebody in a couple of years, you know? And then Giannis is just like in the house and I'm losing my mind because I'm like, oh my God, like it's Giannis, you know? And I like try to compose myself, you know? And then I spend the whole day with them and I'm just like, this guy, like he's so nice. Like he's so normal, you know? And like, it was like, do you need anything else? And normally, like, and I'm sure you could speak this too, David, like sometimes it's like, do you need 2 minutes and get out? You know, it's horrible. But he was just so nice. And, you know, I left feeling like, wow, like what I thought was the story is not the story at all. It's actually a story about two people, two brothers, one family. The profile is going to reveal as much about Giannis as it is going to reveal about Alex. And I felt like the first time I was reading something that talked about the vulnerability of Giannis, the softer sides of Giannis, the mental sides, you know, it really infuriated me that people only wanted to talk about his athleticism, like Greek Freak. Mm-hmm. But the key to his success is his mental fortitude. So I was really intrigued by all that I found about that. And so I was like, maybe this is the book. Like, maybe I should just do this.
Yeah, as the amateur sports fan in the group, well, Jamie might be more of an amateur sports fan than I am. I knew of him, of course. I knew how famous he was, knew how successful he was. And I kind of had the vague outlines of his story. I had no idea. And as I've said to everybody I've met in the last 2 or 3 weeks talking about this book, the word improbable just keeps coming up from every stage of his life. So for the, you know, 95,000 people listening to this, 90,000 might not know, tell us how he started out. Nigerian in Greece. So give us the backstory on Giannis.
Yeah, so Giannis actually wasn't even supposed to be born in Greece. His parents came from Nigeria to go to Germany because Charles, the father, was a soccer player and he had an opportunity to play there. When he got injured and that fell through, the family went to Greece because it is a popular entry point for a lot of immigrants. They either stay there or go somewhere else, and they decided to stay. And Giannis and his three other brothers, he has four brothers total, but the three of them were born there. And Giannis did not even think about basketball. They were dealing with so many difficult issues, from being undocumented to being a regular target of racism. You know, Greece is a very white country. And even though Giannis and his brothers were born there, they were not considered Greek because Greece, unlike America, doesn't offer birthright citizenship. And so they were dealing with all of that. And his parents were selling trinkets on the street and the boys would help out. So sports were just an afterthought. You know, Giannis actually
One of my favorite ones, they would go around and sing Christmas carols, trying to get somebody to throw them a few coins, right? I don't know if most people realize how desperately poor they were.
Yeah, there were days where Giannis didn't eat and he would pretend to eat so that he would tell his brothers, no, I've eaten, you can have my portion. Like people really don't realize how bad it was, but it was actually finding basketball allowed him to make friends and you know, get to know people in his community that would give him food and things like that to get their situation slightly better, but it was still really difficult. So you said the word improbable. Every single part of the journey is improbable.
Every single part.
He was not intending to go to the NBA. He barely got his citizenship papers right before he was supposed to, just because the Greek government realized they could capitalize on his fame. Again, like he was the target of racism. There was a Nazi group, Golden Dawn, patrolling his neighborhood. I mean, there's a million reasons why this person should have never reached the heights that he has.
Okay, David, I want you to jump in this, because one of the things that struck me is that when he's 16, 17, correct me if I get the age wrong, but the scouts from the United States have started to hear about him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 16, 17 years old, but he's not in a program the way kids in the United States are.
Right.
The McDonald's League, you know, whatever that is.
Yeah.
He's not in that program. He's still so poor, Maren, right, that he and his brothers were sharing shoes.
Yeah.
So how does this happen, David? How did they hear about him? What made them think this was worth even considering?
Well, the good thing about basketball is that it's a community and nobody is a secret for very long. Uh-huh. If you can play, if you have any potential, they will find you no matter where you are on earth. They will find you. The thing that is, again, improbable about Giannis is that he was not playing in the top Greek league.
Right.
There's lots of players who have gotten shots, but they almost all came from the top league in Greece. He was playing for like double A team in Greece, for a baseball analogy. He was playing for a double A team. And that just does not happen very often. Yeah. You know, a double A guy all of a sudden is a major leaguer and gets a shot in the major leagues. But I remember before that draft, it's not like people weren't talking about him, but almost all of them said the same. This guy is going to take forever to be even decent as an NBA player.
Yeah.
Like there's no chance he's going to be a star. Well, there was one, and I'm not going to tell you who it was because he talked to me in confidence then, and I'm going to respect that confidence now. There was one GM, he is no longer a GM, that's all I'm going to say, who said, this guy could be Magic Johnson in a couple of years. He's that.
Really?
He's got that kind of potential, but he was the only one. There wasn't anybody else.
Okay, that's stunning. Maren, in the book, person after person says exactly what David just said. Looks good, kind of a useful guy, but if he's going to be great, it's going to take a long time. Very few people saw the greatness, correct?
Yeah. I mean, and now there's been so much revisionist history, like, oh, I knew he was going to be. And it's nobody knew, you know.
Success has 1,000 fathers. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I really appreciated the candor of the Bucks GM and the Hawks GM at the time who, you know, wanted Giannis. And they both told me, like, look, we had no idea. Like, I'm not going to make this more than it is. I saw a really tall guy who was athletic. And both of those things are very valuable in our game. And I thought, why not? Yeah. You know? So
I'm sorry to interrupt. Did they also think they could get him kind of cheaply?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, $1 million is not, you know, drafting at number 15 is totally different than obviously an early lottery pick. And but to Giannis, that's like, oh my God, the amount of money, you know. What I think is interesting is that Giannis got to play because the Bucks were so terrible. So he didn't get stashed away in the development league. He gets to go out there because they've won like 15 games, you know? And it's like, oh my God, can this guy just actually play? Or are they so bad that they're desperate? You know?
What's the line in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king?
That's right.
He probably looked pretty good compared to a lot of them. Okay, talk about the obsession with food, which was understandable because he literally was, and his family, starving. What they would do just to feed themselves. Talk about his obsession with food, which carried through to when he makes it to the pros and he wasn't eating enough. And the Oreos, if you remember the Oreo story.
Yeah, the Oreo story is my favorite in the whole book. So for some context, food was something that, you know, not having it was something Giannis was always aware of. And so he always had to know how much he had and therefore how much to portion out to his brothers. And even when he gets to the NBA, it's not like, oh, cool, I'm a millionaire. I don't feel, you know, empty anymore. I'm good. It's all good. I'm going to eat whatever. Like it was you know, and talk to anyone who has had to go through what he has, you don't change because your financial situation changes. It's traumatic. You're always going to be aware of how much money you have and don't have. It's an impulsive thing. And so he's also very distrustful of people because he doesn't know if they can deport him and his family. So one time he is a rookie at the Bucks and he has to get his cable installed. And he asks that a Bucks staffer be present because again, he doesn't trust people. And the Bucks staffer is there all day and he's super hungry. And he goes into Giannis's pantry and he just takes some Oreos, doesn't really think anything of it. And next day at practice, Giannis is like, "Hey man, did you take my Oreos?" And the guy is like, "What?" And then Giannis is like, "Well, I noticed three were missing." And he's like really visibly upset. Like, "You have just wronged me. Like, you took my Oreos, dude." And, you know, the staffer is just like stunned. Right. But then he realizes, like, of course, Giannis counts as Oreos. Like, this is a guy that has spent 18 years of his life always being so acutely aware of what he has and doesn't have. And just because he's in America doesn't mean that his problems have gone away. In some respects, they've only intensified.
Yeah. Okay. Talk about family, because before, during, and after his incredible success, family's everything to him.
Yeah. There's like close family and then there's Antetokounmpo close. It's a completely different level. Yeah. There is a bond that can only come from being in a situation where you share one pair, you each have one pair of socks and your mom works 14 hours a day and she comes home and washes it because she wants you to have happy memories and go to practice the next day and feel happy. That will create a bond with you and your brothers that is very different from other families that do not know what it's like to struggle. And I think because no item was really individual to each of the brothers, they never really had much conflict because everything was communal. And that goes back to their, you know, Nigerian heritage. Like, they were taught to share, they were taught to enjoy meals together. And so when Giannis makes it in the NBA, one of his central conflicts is that he's doing it alone. They cannot come to America because they don't have the proper documentation. So like I mentioned, the hypocrisy of the Greek government giving Giannis papers, they didn't give it to his family. In fact, in the good year of 2021, Giannis's mother and brother get citizenship only after he becomes immortalizing himself in hoops history and wins an NBA championship, right? Like, they didn't do this in 2013. They did it in 2021. Right. So having said all that, family is so important, but without them for that early period, he nearly quit the NBA, which is, you know, a big part of that early section. And so I think once they were able to find their way to America, Giannis just became brighter and he just really took off as a player.
And that's going to make a big difference, David. There are so many, okay, back in the dark ages, when I was in high school or college, if a guy wanted to play at the NBA, but wasn't good enough, they went to Europe because all the teams there sucked. Right. And there wasn't much competition. But now there are a lot. There's such great talent coming out of Europe. But that family piece of it must be so important because they are relatively young guys. I'm talking primarily about the guys here. But how significant do you think that piece of it was, that he was able to get his family to be with him?
Oh, he wouldn't have. I don't think he would have stayed here, to Marin's point, if his family couldn't have come over to be with him. I mean, they were very, you know, extremely close. She, as Marin writes in the book, much closer than American siblings tend to be, because American siblings tend to have more and they want to have their own bedroom, their own stereo, their own pair of jeans, multiple pairs of jeans.
My boys not only ever shared anything, they would attack each other with cans of Raid. I just want to set the comparison here. So,
So his success was the family success, and he made sure that they were part of it. And literally, to Marin's point, it was over the weekend, right, Marin, when his mom got citizenship? Literally. Like Saturday.
Yeah. Wow.
Like 3 days ago. Twitter was like, "Oh my God, this is so great." I'm just sitting here like, you guys, they gave the family of the country's hero citizenship like 8 years after he like, what are you, this is shameful.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. A lot of things are complicated with Greece. Let's put it that way. Okay. Yeah. So let me get you out with this question about the book and the story. And how did he feel about this book and how did his family feel about the book? And do you stay in touch with them?
I don't know. I know they had it first before anyone else. So they've totally had it for months. I don't know. I hope they like it. I hope they feel seen. Like you just said, we were talking about a family story. there are pages of the book that are just about Alex, that are just about Costas. Like, I really wanted their journeys to have time and space and to feel dignified as well. So I don't know. I hope they like it. I've been hearing a lot from like friends and close people of the family and and just like former people that are really in touch, and they're like, I loved it, so that made me happy. You know, I was nervous.
Absolutely. But I just think the focus of the, a couple of things came through, but if there's one takeaway that I will remember 10 years now from reading this book, it's the family. And that's what he cares about the most, and they care about the most. So I think that's got to work.
All right, okay. Tori, you have to you have to ask Marin about how everybody in our business was rooting for her as the Bucks went from round to round and got to the finals and they have a chance to win. We're like, Merritt's going to make a lot of money on this book and we're happy for her.
Talk about the timing about when the book comes and when all that was happening.
Well, as David said, like, people were just so nice. It got to the point where I was like, do people secretly hate me? I don't know. Like, is it all for show? Like, I just don't know. Cause you know, I'm not used to that. And I was just like, so touched. And like, you know, it was just after every time the Bucks did something good, everyone was like, yay, Mirren. And I was like, yay. It's not just my parents cheering for me. But yeah, it was so unexpected. Like, as you know, like half the book is about how the Bucks are going to Bucks and not do well and screw it up and fall short. And it's about the struggle of being a person from Milwaukee and loving this team. So like, I thought, okay, if they reach like second round, that'll be good. Like, no worries. Then it became clear that they were gonna like go far. I never thought they would win the championship, to be clear. But the, you know, my mentors were like, you gotta get out there more. Like they might go far in the playoffs. Like you gotta promote yourself. And I'm just like, what does that even mean? You know, like I am not used to that. I'm a journalist because I like being in the corner, faceless, nameless. I'm not really present in a lot of my features. And so it was like so bizarre for me to
much
be
harder.
Talking and being vocal and trying to like, you know, I don't know, just like promote. It was just weird. And
was it weird? And David and I have talked about this. Was it weird rooting for a team? As in unabashedly rooting for a team to succeed? Because you're supposed to kind of, you know, subsume your homie instincts, but
yes, because I'm so old school. Like people make fun of me in our industry because I am like a grandmother inside. Like I will not show any, you know, affiliation. I won't let somebody buy me coffee. I won't accept gear from people. I won't let them, I get nervous if I think that they think I'm smiling too much, like with the athlete, like I won't pose for a photo. Like I'm very old school journalist. Okay. So I completely changed and I was like Team Bucks. Like I got t-shirts with my parents and they live like 15 minutes away. And you know, one time I was doing laundry, I forgot my Bucks shirt and they were like, they're going to lose and it's your fault.
Oh yeah.
We wear it every game. And I got so into it. I became, and I interviewed so many Bucks fans for the book. And so I became friends with this whole new group of fans and they welcomed me into it. There was no gatekeeping. There was no like, sorry, you've been rooting for the Lakers since the beginning of time. Yeah. We don't want you. And so it's just, it felt so good to just be happy and cheering on a game. I feel like I just gotten so cynical and who cares about it? But I was so into it and happy.
Excellent. We're all thrilled for Marin. All of
absolutely
us. Because it worked out perfectly.
Timing is everything.
I do have one question about this fairy tale ending to this story. Is this a true story?
Are we doing fiction or nonfiction?
It's really hard
tonight
to believe.
I know.
I think it'd work out so well. Do you think 20 years from now you'll end up writing another book about what happened in the next chapters in his life?
I have to do an epilogue due in like T minus 1 week. And I'm just like, this is so, everything goes right. This is so boring. How do I like write this? And I'm like,
Kevin
damn.
Garnett's got big feet. That's why.
Yeah. Like what, how do I explain this? You know, and it's just reliving it. It's just wild. And I was trying to write the Chick-fil-A scene without being like corny and it literally does feel unreal. Still, I'm still in shock. And I think because we're doing so much promo, I didn't have time to just decompress and like really think about all that has happened, but is really ridiculous. I don't know. Maybe I'll write a sequel, but I think whoever does the next Giannis biography is going to do such a great job, because he's going to grow up and talk more about off the court stuff, I think, in ways that he's extremely tight-lipped about now. And I think that person will have such a good time working on this.
That's the problem if you're writing fact-based, you know, journalism, essentially, is you know, you don't have that latitude. For instance, in The Natural, we all know that Roy Hobbs strikes out in the end.
In the book.
In the book.
Yes.
And you know, that didn't test well with audiences, so we came back to more of a Giannis narrative there for the end of that story.
Giannis' story so far is pretty good. What'll be fun at some point, Mirren, and this show will still be on the air 15 years from now, just put it down for 5-10 years and then pick it up and go back and look at it. I think you're going to be really impressed. But who's next? Who? What person or what story is next in your pipeline that you can tell us?
I think I have found my subject for book number two, but I'm not sure, because it's the chicken or the egg. Do you reach out first? What if they shut you down? And then you, like, I don't want to approach something like that. So I can't.
If you're asking about David, I can do that. I could go to David quietly and say, okay, it's like sixth grade. If this boy said he liked you, how would you respond?
Check yes or no. Well,
do you like if that? Only it were like that. I hear
you know, Mirren, one of the things that you said that really impressed me is somebody who I taught journalism for a few years ago. And one of the things I would always tell my students, and I tried to practice this when I was a reporter, was to not have a preconceived idea of what the story is. My students would come to me and say, I'm going to go do a story about this, and it's going to be, this is how the story goes. And I would say, just when you go there, just listen and look around, because so many times the real story is not the story you thought you went there. So when you talked about how you went there and thought you were going to do one thing, but you sort of realized what the real story was, it really resonated with me, because that was a lesson that I found that some of my journalism students, it took them a while to get to that point where they had to realize that the real stories are out there, but you have to be tuned in and listening and be sensitive to what they are.
I mean, I feel like my entire journalism experience has taught me that as like the definitive lesson. Like when I started out and I was really struggling to get a full-time journalism job, I would pitch freelance stories and the editor would always ask me, so what's the hook? What's the angle? What's it about? And I just sitting there like, am I crazy? Like, how am I supposed to know the hook before I do the work? Like, how do I haven't talked to anyone. How do you expect me to know the whole thing? And so I just feel like we're taught like this idea of journalism that you could just do from your home instead of the exciting, thrilling part, which is getting out there and finding the story. And so, you know, to keep it short, I was sent to Lithuania to do this story on the Mellow Ball. And the story they told me to write was a happy, positive, fun child star takes Europe. And I went there and it was cold, scary, weird, worst league ever. Dad is taken over. It's nothing like anyone ever sees. And you have a moral responsibility, right? Do you just write the story they want you to do, or do you write what you're seeing and hearing? And that's what I did. And it just taught me so much.
Good for you. We are back next week with Nevo, who is the author of The Chosen, The Beautiful. Our friend Ron Charles in the Washington Post has likened it to The Great Gatsby, but he added, this is a version of The Great Gatsby in which partygoers drink demon blood, sorcery twists the beams of reality, and Jay Gatsby is a bisexual vampire, but it's supposed to be great. Mirren Fader, thank you so much. Best of luck. You don't need any more luck. It's a fabulous book. Giannis, the improbable.
Love Mirren Fader.
Of an NBA MVP. David, Jamie, Lauren, thank you all very much. Everybody, listeners, thanks for listening. Stay well, and we'll see you next week. Thanks, guys.